And now, the man who brought down Nixon, Mike Cannon.
Welcome back to the second hour of this continuing coverage of what happened last week at the RNC in St. Paul, with news reports that did not get out to the rest of the world. Coming up next, we'll have some segments about how they targeted video journalists who specifically had a history with Cop Watch activities. That's next. This is a special edition of the Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio program. Thanks for listening.
Network. Well, police in St. Paul are being accused of continuing to intimidate a group of video makers that traveled to the Twin Cities to document police misconduct during the Republican National Convention. On Saturday, police raided a home where members of Eyewitness Video Collective were staying. Members of the group were detained for over 2 hours. We talked about that on Monday. Well, yesterday, police armed with batons and battering ram entered a St. Paul office building that housed the offices of Eyewitness Video. Police claimed they were investigating reports of anarchists holding hostages in the building. Members of Eyewitness Video accused the police of blatant harassment and of using the bogus hostage claim to seek entry to their office. Lawyers and legal observers from the National Lawyers Guild described what happened.
Well, I was in the middle of a legal conference in a conference room. There were a lot of law offices in the building, and suddenly there were three or four St. Paul police officers poking their head, looking through a particular door.
And they were jumping. They were holding onto the ledge and trying to jump up it so they could see inside the office, and they weren't able to see inside the office. And they were saying that there was either somebody being kidnapped, somebody being held against their will. They told me that somebody, an undercover, had told them that the anarchists were holding people hostage in our building. I work for the NLG here. We're working out of one of our lawyers' offices. I said, is it in our law office? They said, no, it's upstairs. They then came into the building with me. I showed them what was going on upstairs.
They said that the call did not come into 911. The call came into the RNC part of the policing. And we questioned strongly why a report of a kidnapping would do that and how strange the scenario was.
I then asked the police to leave since nobody was obviously being held hostage here, and they refused. Eventually, their head sergeant came here and decided that they could leave the building.
While the kidnapping report turned out to be false, the incident had an immediate effect on the work of Eyewitness Video. After the group held an impromptu news conference outside, the building's landlord forced the group to move out. Democracy Now! Caught up with members of Eyewitness Video Collective as they pack their belongings.
Basically, the landlord freaked out, and the legal office that's managing all the criminal defense of all the people during the convention here, who people were arrested, they were told if we didn't leave, they would be kicked out also. So we couldn't let that happen. These folks are here filing today a very important lawsuit. They're trying to get people released from jail. They're trying to stop some of these crazy things that the St. Paul police are doing in conjunction with the FBI and the Minneapolis police and so on. And so we really have no choice. We have to go to them.
I'm a videographer. My name's Amy Sharp, and I work with Eyewitness. You know, it's just a tactic to stop us from working because we're actually doing a good job.
Many of us have been detained, house arrest. We've been harassing the streets personally. So a lot of policemen have miscalled us.
Yep, blank tape in case we need them. And a whole bunch of other stuff that we were using in our office to do our work. It has been seriously disrupted.
Who needs this? Who needs to have, you know, police agents and battering rams show up to your office building? I would understand that a landlord would feel, you know, kind of concerned, and the tenants might feel concerned.
If journalists, including citizen journalists, including documentarians, including anybody who takes a camera out there to document what really happens on our streets, in our communities, people who do that are protecting a political democracy. They're protecting what governs how we live here. And if we take away the right of people to do that, we really put our political system at risk.
We're joined right now by Eileen Clancy of Eyewitness Video at St. Paul Neighborhood Network. We're staying with Bruce Nestor, who's head of National Lawyers Guild here. Eileen Clancy, the police came to your office for the second time yesterday with battering ram.
Well, we didn't see it because we were inside. That's what the attorney, Geneva Finn, you saw just a little while ago, told us, that they were unloading equipment from the vehicle. She spoke to them, and at that point, somehow, she was told that there was this whole story about there were barricaded hostages.
That you had hostages inside?
I don't think they referred to Eyewitness Video specifically, but they went up on the second floor of that building and they came right in front of our door. And we were able to see one of our group members saw the police were there next door talking to people and became concerned. And we notified the legal office. We were inside. We had the door locked because there's no peephole in that door. We had a little closed circuit camera. And so we looked at this little image just of half a police officer's body, and we were just, you know, we knew they were outside the door, and we didn't know what it meant. When I called the attorney who was outside and speaking to the police, and she related this tale that there were barricaded hostages, if that's what the police were saying, we had about, I don't know, half a dozen of us in that room, and we were just dumbfounded. I mean, it was just dumbfounded. It's just a completely insane.
Why are you in St. Paul?
We're in St. Paul to document the demonstrations around the Republican convention, and including particularly the policing. And, you know, we're seeking to understand how the demonstrations are policed and how the whole actually federal apparatus works of surveillance and things like that.
Can you explain your role in the RNC documentation project in 2004? 1,800 people were arrested. You have thousands of videotapes from that time? Thousands?
Oh, no.
Or hundreds?
No, not thousands. there's hundreds of them.
Uh-huh.
There's hundreds of them.
And what were they used to do in terms of lawsuits?
Well, we worked with the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild directly on the criminal defense of people who are arrested. And what we discovered was that the police had lied so thoroughly and so often that if you were able to take the police statements, the police affidavits of the charges, and put them up against the video, that many times the cases completely fell apart.
How many cases fell apart?
We say that there's 400 criminal cases where the charges were dropped or there was an acquittal directly related, solely related to video evidence.
Now, the New York police are working with the St. Paul and Minneapolis police. They work with the police in Denver. Do you think there's a relationship between so many of the cases, hundreds of cases falling apart based on evidence that you had in New York, now in St. Paul, not wanting the cases, the stories, the arrests documented like this?
Well, one has to wonder. I mean, this is an extraordinary amount of pressure to put on us. What happened yesterday really ratcheted up the stakes because, you know, they came in with a warrant even though it had the wrong address the other day, and we had guns pointed at us. And then yesterday...
In that case, we got there on Saturday.
Yeah,
asked a police officer about the weapons. He said, yes, there was an AR-15 automatic rifle there.
That the police were carrying.
Right. They came in at you on Saturday with a pistol drawn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They had loaded.
Bruce Nestor, what about the significance of saying perhaps if there are hostages inside, wouldn't that give them a legitimate right to shoot?
It would, and it allows them to enter without a warrant in that type of situation.
So that's the case, without a warrant.
That's the basis, I would believe, for that type of allegation, yes.
Are you concerned about what's happening here?
You look at a pattern of the Glass Bead Collective being arrested, or another group of videographers. You look at Eyewitness Video being targeted twice. You look at the sweep arrests of journalists, the targeting of other journalists. You also have to understand in Minneapolis back in August of 2007, we had a critical mass bike ride where 19 people were charged with these probable cause riot charges. Only 5 people, of course, were ever formally charged with anything. A case that went to trial, actually a person with the RNC welcoming committee was acquitted because video evidence showed the officers lying. Another client of mine charged with various gross misdemeanors. Cases were dismissed because the video showed officers were lying. So local police have the same experience that they've had in New York City. They're working with the police in New York City. I mean, I can't have any concrete evidence that they're saying, let's go get eyewitness video. But you got to start to ask the question, why are they repeatedly going after these same people when the work has been so effective in responding to police abuses?
I want to thank you both for being with us. We're going to go inside the convention now. Bruce Nestor, president of the Minnesota chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, and Eileen Clancy. She is the founder of Eyewitness Video. We will continue to document how they are able to document things here through the end of this convention. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We're breaking with convention back in a minute.
You know you only had one shot to make it right, to do the right thing. So listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
Up next, we'll be having a press conference with a 19-year-old who claimed he was tortured while at Ramsey County lockup. This is a much longer version of what you heard earlier in This Week in Radical History. Thanks for listening.
My name is Elliot Hughes, ELLIOTHUGHES. Me and some friends were chanting so that we could receive food in Ramsey County Jail because we hadn't been provided food. Six or seven officers came into my cell and they took one officer punched me in the face right here where you see this bruise, and then they slammed and I fell to the ground unconscious, and the officer grabbed me by the head, slammed my head on the ground, and reawoke me out of to consciousness. And I was bleeding everywhere. They dragged me to another detaining cell. They put a bag over my head that had a gag on it, and they used pain compliance tactics on me for about an hour and a half. They separated my jaw as hard as they could with their fingers, and they bent my ankles back. They basically bent my foot backwards. I was screaming for God and screaming for mercy, crying, asking them why they were doing this. And I've never been so violated in my life. I was extremely traumatized. Shortly after that, they took me to the hospital and gave me stitches, and I was refused to speak with a social worker.
Which hospital?
Regents Hospital.
Are you going to bring legal charges?
Huh?
Are you going to attempt to bring legal charges?
Yes.
Do you know the names of any of the officers?
I had a mask over my face.
What day was this?
It was two nights ago.
Monday night?
I think we have a question in the back.
Elliot, how old are you?
I'm 19 years old.
And when and where were you arrested?
I was arrested in downtown St. Paul because I was biking and an officer on a bicycle crashed into me. And that officer said that it was okay, I didn't do it on purpose. And then I was arrested by several other officers. And there's video of this online.
You say they didn't give you any food? Did they give you any food?
I was. They did. They had given me food, but there was a point where I went without food for about 12 hours. I had been coughing up blood, and vomiting. And I fainted once because I wasn't receiving any food, and I was like dry heaving and vomiting. And one officer said that I was being bulimic, which I felt extremely offended by. I was being called gay by multiple officers, called the princess. When they had this bag around my head while I was being tortured, I was concussed, and later I was in a holding cell in Regents Hospital, and I had thrown up in the bag that was around my head, and I was begging them to take it off of my face, and they would not take the bag off of my head.
Can you explain how they rode into you?
The sheriff or city, city police is in jail for special.
Huh?
Any of the police officers that you saw in the jail, were they from the sheriff's department who supposedly controlled the jail?
The
city police or others?
They were from the sheriff's department and from, and from the jail also.
Can you explain better this event precipitating your arrest that you said that the cop ran into you on the bike? Where were you? What happened? Was it a...
There was a march of about 15 people, I think I'm going to stop soon. There's a video available on YouTube of...
How do we find it?
It's, I think you just...
What's your name?
Yeah, just search for it.
Okay, up next, a short segment from other people released from Ramsey County Jail last week in St. Paul, and that'll be followed by a short piece from the Submedia Guy. You're listening to a special edition of the Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Programming, concentrating on the police riots that occurred in St. Paul, Minneapolis area last week during the RNC convention.
I do not feel I was doing anything illegal. At the time I was arrested, there was probably about 25 to 30 of us walking down the sidewalk, and we stopped on the corner, and there was a group of about 20 bike cops who came up behind us and encircled us and cornered us on the corner and told us to put our hands up, and then whoever didn't put their hands up, they pepper sprayed, and they wouldn't answer our questions about whether or not we were being detained, and then we were told to kneel. They had us stay kneeling for at least an hour on the sidewalk while they decided what the hell they were doing with us. The cops were really incredibly disorganized throughout the entire process, like both outside and inside the jail.
And did the cops end up charging you with something?
I've been charged with 3 misdemeanors, obstructing the legal process because I refused to give my name, unlawful assembly, and disorderly conduct.
And so you have to return for a court date? Or?
Yeah, I have an October 2nd court date, but I had a really fantastic National Lawyers Guild lawyer, and she felt pretty confident that a lot of the charges will be thrown out in the interim time, so I'm hoping I won't have to come back.
So they let you go even though you didn't give your name? Or?
I did eventually give my name when they threatened us with jail sentence of 30 days with being in contempt of court.
And do you think there's a chance that you'll find out that threat was empty? Or?
It was being questioned at the time by the lawyers there, but they certainly could have held me for a while.
Hi, my name's Isaac. I'm from Baltimore, and I was just released from the Ramsey Adult Detention Center. I was arrested on several charges, but had them dropped down to interference with public property, and I was released on minor recognizance. Inside, we used jail solidarity tactics, such as not giving our names up until our trials or our bail hearings, and we staged a hunger strike to get vegan food for everyone, which was successful, at least in Pod A, where I was held. We also managed to get meds for two other prisoners who needed it using those tactics, and it sounds like all the false charges of felony riot that have been given to most of the people in there are being dropped down to unlawful assembly, so that's a victory.
Yeah! Well, my name's Cameron Kennedy. I was checking out the Guantanamo Bay demonstration when we came across this anti-capitalist protest, and we decided to join up with them. We kept going along this street, and we came across a bunch of police, at which point we didn't know what they wanted us to do. They didn't give us any issues to disperse, so we thought maybe we could cross the street. At that point, they opened up on us with everything, tear gas, rubber bullets, mace, percussion grenades. So we went an instant retreat. We got rounded up at the park. Half of us were innocent there, like had nothing to do with the protest. Even that, the protest is legal itself. And then they circled us all in. Apparently they told us to disperse several times then too, but nobody heard it. And then they told us all we were arrested. They made sure that, though, that, you know, we were arrested. And we all put our hands on our head, and that was that. It was pretty nasty. I had a friend come out with a split hand from a tear gas canister. I had a mace canister blow up in my face. It was nasty. So when we were detained, it took about 12 hours to process me. I was in zip ties for the better part of 6 hours, and they were put on a little too tight. So try sitting around in a bus with zip ties behind your back that entire time. Well, we got into prison. It took them 12 hours since our arresting point to actually get us into our cells, at which point we started making a lot of noise and, you know, chanting solidarity forever. Last night, however, it was reminiscent of Guantanamo Bay. We were chanting. We were trying to make it seem like the zoo it was, so we were all making animal noises. They told one of the kids to shut up, and they opened up his cell door. From what we saw from the other side, he got hit in the head, and they tased him for what seemed to be like 15 minutes. He was screaming for help the entire time, and we were locked in our cells, and we weren't able to do anything about it. And it was truly a terrifying experience. I'm on felony charges as of right now for essentially walking down a sidewalk. So, yeah, the entire situation was poorly orchestrated, poorly organized, and nobody deserves to be in there.
Got arrested in some parking lot, 4th and Kellogg. Coming up to the arrest, there was a street medic. The cops clubbed this person in the head with the riot stick and then just stood over him yelling about how they weren't supposed to go anywhere. And then they moved in on us, baton charges and pepper spray and stuff, and shoved some people to the ground. A lot of people started going to the ground in compliance, and then they just ran over us and hosed us down with pepper spray. They kicked some people in the face, did things like that. In jail, it was over 23-hour-a-day lockdown, and they did definitely beat up a kid in jail, beat up his face, and also did extensive pain compliance.
And the whole situation here was really convoluted. The authorities were using a lot of brutality. When I was arrested at 7th and Jackson in downtown St. Paul, none of the protesters that I was with had any weapons on them, and when everyone obeyed the police and got down on their hands and knees and bellies, the police still came around and like pepper sprayed the shit out of people. There was use of batons, so a lot of people got roughed up and got their faces smashed into the asphalt. They tightened our zip cuffs extremely tight, didn't give us any water for quite some time, and I know that one fellow cellmate in my cell block on a Tuesday night around 9:45 was beaten up by about 12 correctional officers. They pepper sprayed him in his cell, took him out of the cell kicking and screaming. You could see blood on his face. Yeah, I mean, I feel like it was really horrendous, the whole process here in St. Paul.
It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
Good morning, slaves, and welcome to another edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine, the show where evildoers reside. I am your host, The Simulator, and as I type this, word is out that Fed and state employees have been told to evacuate their buildings in St. Popo. Seems the police state is cranking up the heat and getting ready for a final showdown with the motherfucking resistance. All within the backdrop of rich, Jesus-loving white folks that don't give a fuck about you.
Mr. Kissinger, what do you say to people who call you a war criminal? What do you say to people?
On the bright side of the news, pepper spray cameraman Lambert Rochford was released late last night.
No, I got my money and I got a little plastic bag that had like all the stuff in my pockets in it.
Right here, I almost left it on the ground.
So that had like my wallet.
Yeah.
You know, like my bandana.
Oh, they gave you the bandana back.
My phone, my car keys.
Your bandana's in here?
Portland Indy Media reporter Wendy Minion was also released from captivity.
I wasn't allowed to get out of my cell, but some of them were allowed to get out of theirs, so they were kind of walking around when they had the opportunity. And so when they had the opportunity and I wasn't being watched, I would put this up in the little tiny window that they had. So they didn't have the food flap open, so I could barely talk to people, so we'd have to get down by the ground, and then I started hearing testimonies, so I started documenting it with a contraband pencil that they gave me to fill up my own medical form, and then forgot that I had. So I started saying, you know, basically that there's people, one woman in for 28 hours with no call, one woman in for 21 hours, several people were in the same bus with Amy Goodman, who had already been processed and released, and they still hadn't gotten any recourse.
The poll also keep harassing New York City Cop Watchers eyewitness video. Yesterday, the SPPD attempted to enter their offices with some made-up excuse.
The police entered the building. There were four or five police officers in the building. We were just standing around with them until their sergeant showed up. So one of the officers like tried to look inside the eyewitness office. They like held onto the ledge and tried to pull himself up to look through the window into the office. I guess they were really persuaded that somebody was being held against their will up there. But then eyewitnesses' counsel showed up, and he went into the office, and there was nobody being held hostage.
And finally, eight members from the RNC Welcoming Committee were charged with conspiracy to commit terrorism. Thank you. the final moments of this convention, I have very little time to digest all the shit has gone down. I will not speak for everyone I work with, but personally I have experienced every single emotion in existence. Waves of fear, anger, paranoia, love, rage, and so on would pass through me each and every day. I've experienced heartbreaking moments that sometimes made me want to quit. I even cried a little. Really. Thankfully, I was surrounded by some real hardcore motherfuckers me going. Not with their words, but with their fearless actions. This historic moment is not over, but since I might not be here to produce another show, I wanted to say what's up to all the heroes putting shit on the line under the towering shadow of the fascist corporate state. Nice rhetoric, eh?
Up next, and perhaps till the end of the hour, more reports from the draconian measures taken last week in St. Paul, this by the producers of Flashpoint. I'll be back at the end of the show. You are listening to my Canon New Media Radio program, normally heard every Monday from 2 to 6, with special coverage of the police riots in St. Paul from last week. Thanks for listening.
Today on Flashpoints, the military and the police clear downtown St. Paul in anticipation of John McCain's speech before the Republican National Committee and Convention. I'm Dennis Bernstein. We broadcast from St. Paul, where the streets are covered with police, Homeland Security, and soldiers. We broadcast to you from an undisclosed location. We have been cleared out of our building, our headquarters in the Indigenous Multicultural Academy, and I'm here with Bill Means, who was also cleared out of his building as the police went building to building, clearing people out. And Bill, before we hear a press conference that just took place about police violence and police overreaction, what's your response? We were told that at the school there was some kind of bomb threat. We had to leave. But it seems as though they had planned to clear out the entire downtown of St. Paul.
You know, early on, about 6 months ago, they started planning for this convention, and they told us to be ready as employees. I don't work for the state, but the building I'm in is full of state employees. I work for Minnesota Indian OIC State Council. However, we are part of the state, gives us office space, so I'm in with approximately maybe 4,000 to 5,000 employees on at least three floors that we have in the what's known as the First National Bank Building, 5th Street in Minnesota in downtown St. Paul. But at about 11 o'clock this morning, we were all informed that by noon we had to be out of the building. So you can see it was a pretty mass evacuation in a short time. And the only reason we were given it was an order of Homeland Security. And there was no question, there was no asking why or any delay. They told us the time we had to be out, and that was it. So my secretary had gotten a word, called me, I had to go in, check things out, and everybody was leaving in a timely manner. But it was it was totally upsetting in the sense that masses of people, just on a word like Homeland Security, be ready to move, leave. There was no reason actually given. So there was a bit of, kind of very tense moments there because people don't know whether to run or take the elevator. Everybody go down the stairs. It's not a fire, but yet it's an imminent threat, as stated by the Homeland Security. So it was very upsetting and kind of nervous moments there. You don't know if people are going to get trampled or panic, but everybody seemed to go out fairly quickly, and I think that's because throughout the last 6 months they've been telling us there may be times of evacuation, fire drills, etc. So we've been on alert, but it was very surprising and very tense to move that many people in that short a time.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I'm Dennis Bernstein speaking with Bill Means. He is an official and on the board of the American Indian Movement here in Minnesota. We're in St. Paul. And, Bill, before we go to this press conference where we're going to hear a great deal about what appears to be a conspiracy by the police and various levels of police, national security, federal police. Before we go to that press conference, what do you think is at play here? What do you think the real story is, the real politic here?
Well, I think it's a practice run for implementing a form of martial law wherever it may be, whether in Minnesota, Florida, Arizona, along the border, wherever there's imminent danger of a mass law enforcement occupation. I think they're practicing for that, be it a military base, be it the border itself, down in the southwest, maybe it's federal buildings and landmarks, New York City, you know, all these places that have been targeted in the news media for possible terrorist threats. I think they're actually practicing, not only for that, but whatever may come as a result of police occupation. It's kind of like a militarization of the local job of protect and serve. It's going to a whole new level from being a police watching a neighborhood. We now have Army, National Guard, U.S. Marshals, Homeland Security, FBI.
93.3 WNRB LP Wausau.
And they sort of push the local cops off to direct traffic, and they occupy a city. So it's like, what happened to states' rights? What happened to community input? What happened to the First Amendment?
Well, we're going to hear a lot more about what happened to it as we move into this press conference, which just happened a few minutes before airtime. We were there. The Flashpoints team was there here in St. Paul. Bill Means, we thank you for being our guest host. We've got one more day. We want to remind people that we will be live going national tomorrow from St. Paul, so you can tune into that live at 5 o'clock Pacific time. And now we go to the press conference about police violence and police overreaction in St. Paul in the shadows of the Republican convention.
So my name is Bruce Nestor. I represent Monica Bicking, one of the eight charged at this time. And I guess when I say eight charged, I also want to say that, as many of you know, Monica Bickman was released initially, and then when she went back to the jail in order to watch the bail hearings for the other people, she was taken into custody. And even though the sheriff saw fit to release her, and then she then showed up at the jail, the judge evidently decided she was a risk of flight and set bond again. But at that time, a Carrie Feldman was also arrested, and we believe are now facing the same probable cause riot charges. So we're now looking at least probably nine people rather than eight. Of that nine, eight have been released from custody. Three are here with us today, Max Spector, Lutza Guillen-Givens, and Robert Serznick, right? The fourth, Nathaniel Spector, is on his way. The other four just had bond posted for them within the past couple hours, and the jail's on lockdown for shift change until 3:30, so they're unable to join us as we expected. We also have the attorneys. Larry Leventhal is the attorney for Max Spector. Jordan Kushner is the attorney for Lutza Guillen-Givens, and I'm the attorney for Monica Bickman. Four of the others are currently represented by the Office of the Ramsey County Public Defender. And then for family members with us today, we have Mordecai Spector, the father of Max Spector, and Kira Fitzgerald, the father of Garrett Fitzgerald, who's one just been bailed out and is on our way over here. So I'm going to introduce Larry Leventhal, who's going to speak a little bit. But just to summarize, all eight of these defendants have, and we're expecting it to be nine, have been charged with conspiracy to commit riot and furtherance of terrorism. Six people were picked up on Saturday, four at the house raids, two taken off the streets, none with criminal arrest warrants. One of our early complaints in this process was the fact that the sheriff claims this was a year-long investigation, that they have solid evidence to support their investigation, and yet they chose not to present criminal arrest warrants. They chose not to present the matter to the prosecuting attorney or to the court to approve a warrant, thereby really resulting in preventative detention of people denying them access to court and denying them the opportunity to post bail had they been arrested prior to Saturday morning. Two other arrests then occurred in vehicle stops on Monday, I believe, and then with Ms. Feldman being the ninth arrest when she went to court on, must have been on Tuesday, I guess, or Wednesday morning. In particular, the charges in this case are supported only by allegations of paid confidential informants. A number of the attorneys here have experience in investigations with the use of informants in political cases. We are concerned about the potential use of provocateurs, people who purposely plan and bring up discussions of violence in order to get other people to respond and then report back that those discussions occurred. The confidential informants are paid based on the value of the information they provide. They have a clear incentive to exaggerate and lie about the information. The evidence in this case, the allegations of violence, the kidnapping of delegates, the most outrageous allegations made by the authorities are not supported by any evidence other than the statements of the confidential informants. They're not supported by the evidence seized. We've also seen what appear to be fabrications with respect to descriptions of the evidence seized out of the homes. In particular, there's this ongoing repetition, both by Sheriff Fletcher and by the media, regarding the seizure of urine when the actual pictures show, and it's easy to document, that those substances were mostly kitchen gray water and were not associated in any way with any of these defendants. We have other common household items being described repeatedly in the media as bomb-making materials, when what we're talking about are glass bottles, cloth rags, and charcoal lighter fluid, all of which were found separated from each other in different parts of houses, different houses, different locations, all of which are common household items, none of which were in any sort of assembled form. We have search warrants seeking gunpowder, explosive materials, Molotov cocktails, none of which were found. We have the sheriff displaying a single plastic item that he claims was a shield, as if somehow one shield was going to protect demonstrators from 3,500 armed riot police who have projectile tear gas weapons. And so overall, the mode and method of the investigation, the fact that the evidence seized does not support the allegations, and the use of a terrorism charge to take what were public statements of peaceful blockades of roads to equate that with terrorism, both trivializing the real violence and also putting anybody at risk who is organizing political demonstrations involving civil disobedience with the potential of being labeled a domestic terrorist. And with that, I'd ask Larry to make some comments.
There were complaints that were issued yesterday against eight individuals, which basically seek to bring the wrath of the state with big names of domestic terrorism, conspiracy, armed yet, which have no relationship to the facts as we've been able to see them to date. Rather, they take disparate statements made at different locations according to different informers and attempt to say that individuals who may or may not have been at a particular meeting subscribe to the most dramatic statement that the confidential informants cared to report. Thus, we have statements of bombs ready to blow up buildings and delegates ready to be kidnapped when there's been nothing like that. We see that they've put out names of people and said these individuals were all working together in a group, were all in communication with each other, and therefore anything that anybody said, even in another part of a country, is something that they're holding against them. What is interesting is if you look through this, there's a list of all sorts of things they expected, but if we ask, is there any of the defendants who is said to have physically attacked someone? Is there any of the defendants who is said to have physically even broken a window? And the information that they put in the complaint really does not present that. This is something that was put together before the convention started. and names were put in. A couple updates at the end were thrown there. And what they have weaved is a narrative of various meetings that they claim occurred over a number of years. We do not have the events. We have basically, they're saying, here are some people they've associated with other bad people, and those people have done bad things. If we were to accept the standard that people who associate with others who may do bad things are subject to arrest, and that certainly should not be a standard in a civilized society, but if that were the standard, there's a lot of delegates who are in the Excel Center that have been associating with bad people who have done very bad things. There's much more cause, it would seem, if the standard were those who associate with bad people, they should be inside, not outside the Excel Center. We have what has been initiated, a political prosecution. You can tell a political prosecution because people are being charged and sought and imprisoned for their thoughts, for their ideas, which may be different from the reigning political powers, rather than for things that they have done. And as we look through the papers we have, we see lists of what people were said to have said, and mostly not any of the defendants, and saying they were going to do this, and we see this basis in search warrants where they find things like tires or gasoline or mirrors or things anybody has around the house and say, this is evidence of terrorism, this is evidence of people who have formed the conspiracy. What we are going to show is that what the evidence primarily shows is that there has been a campaign against people who do not believe as the Republican convention officials wish them to believe. And we can walk around the streets of St. Paul and see different police units on horseback, on motorcycles, on bicycles, wearing one form of riot gear or another form of riot gear. And when you get people together like that and told that their mission is to interfere with activities real or imagined, we can see why there has been police that have been overreacting, public officials that have been overreacting. And when you overreact, there seems to be a need to spin a web of things happening that are greater than anybody imagined and anybody was doing. And what we're seeing in the papers that are describing activities is such a web of he said that she said years ago, months ago, and someplace else, but these people talk to other people and they're all part of a conspiracy is what the claim is. We are pledged to show that that type of claim has no reality, and that type of claim does not fit into a democratic society where people are merely expressing views. It may be, and has been, that there have been broken windows and people taking actions that they shouldn't have taken. But to attempt to say that people that they've singled out in advance are somehow responsible for things that happened when they weren't there, it gets to the area of where it becomes very improbable and becomes a manifestation of political statements rather than being anything that is a criminal act. If you separate the criminal acts from statements that are being made in allegations based upon he said that she said, we'll see that there is a very different reality that is actual from the web of circumstances which the government is trying to spin. Thank you. We have another attorney who's here, Jordan Kirshner, who will also have some remarks.
In the legislation that started being passed after 9/11, mostly on the federal level, but in the charges in this case on the state level, a lot of people who were concerned about civil liberties were warning about terrorism being used to go way beyond prosecuting anything that had to do with terrorism, that the laws that were being passed were so broad that they were obviously being used potentially to go after people based on legitimate political dissent and ultimately to suppress free speech and genuine movements for change in this country. We've gotten to that point now. First, they just went after people, didn't pay much attention because they captured people who are Muslim abroad and put them in detention camps here and overseas, and it didn't get much attention. It didn't get much attention when thousands of immigrants were placed in detention indefinitely. The warnings of civil liberties people was worth, you know, eventually it's going to come home. And that's what we're seeing here. We're seeing the state of Minnesota, in this case Ramsey County specifically, taking the lead in the most manipulative, cynical, demagogic, and abusive fashion, or using the buzzword of terrorism to persecute people for political dissent, for having unconventional views. All they do is they label people as terrorists and anarchists, and at that point, what people are actually saying and the content of their views has no meaning anymore. What they do is they dehumanize people, they stigmatize them, and in the process, cut off what they're saying. And in this point, not only by marginalizing people and not paying attention to them, but actually using the criminal justice system as a severe bludgeon to cut off people in their efforts to be politically involved. And in this case, we have, if you look at the complaint, which as has been pointed out, most of the allegations come from an informant who was paid money. And the way this works, and we know this from, if you looked at the City Page article about the person who was approached to be a mole in anarchist groups, they were told that they would be paid based on the value of the information that they provided. So we're talking about someone who, how much money he makes depends on how bad the accusations he's able to come up with. So we have the government spying on a group that's engaged in political dissent. So we have a police spying type state. And we have propped up, trumped up allegations. And ultimately, people are being persecuted for actions that were accepted in this country as part of our tradition. We've had labor movements at the turn of the century and the Great Depression, and we've had the civil rights movements in the 1960s, where it's understood that when people aren't getting a voice in the country, they take it to the streets. They organize other people, they take it to the streets, and yes, they cause disruptions sometimes, because in the unequal balance of power that we have, and more than ever, where how much you can get to the airwaves depends on how much you can buy, the only route people have left is to demonstrate and do grassroots street actions. And historically, that's always involved some degree of disruption, but we're talking ultimately about nonviolent disruption. We're talking about people trying to stop business from happening. That's what's alleged in the complaint. We're talking about traditional civil disobedience here, and that's being made out in this complaint to be about, and that suddenly turned into terrorism. And if you look at the state statute in Minnesota as to how terrorism is defined, it is just so broad that anything that gets in the way of the government could be defined as terrorism. And they're using that extremely broad statute in the most abusive sort of way to prosecute political dissidents who are engaging in their most fundamental right and valued right in this country to express their views, organize other people, and convince them to participate in their expression of views with them, and then to preemptively arrest them purposely so that they can't actually participate in demonstrations, and then afterwards to charge them with felonies. The abuse here was the violence of the state. That's the closest thing that we've had here to terrorism in these protests. If you look at how those police were dressed, and I'm sure some people were here to see that in their Darth Vader outfits, $1.9 million spent on chemical irritants, which were sprayed indiscriminately on people all over the place, all kinds of riot gear, all on almost completely unarmed protesters who all they were doing were marching in the street. That's where the abuse is taking place. And that's being covered up by going after ordinary people who are trying to engage in activism. My client is Lutza Guillen-Givens, And if you, the allegations against her are that she was seen going to many meetings. She traveled around the country meeting with people, talking about participating in the actions to protest against the Republican National Convention. If you heard the prosecutor in court yesterday, all he talked about was how people were associated with the RNC Welcoming Committee. And so being associated with a group in and of itself becomes a crime. And that's the next thing that this is about. This is about guilt by association. If you associate with people that the government doesn't like, if you participate in groups to organize and advocate, now that becomes criminalized. I think this is a more dangerous precedent in this country that we probably had at any time since the World War I and the aftermath of World War I with the Palmer Raids, where people were indiscriminately rounded up based on political dissent and thousands of people were deported. Before World War I, where anti-war activists were sentenced to prison for their views. You would have thought that we got way beyond that, that there's some level of historical consciousness, at least by the people making and enforcing the law, that that's not something you do, that people have a right to dissent. I mean, the last time we had a trial that prosecuted people for doing a street demonstration nationally was the Chicago 8 trial in 1968. And, of course, that made complete fools out of the government. It became very clear. And when the evidence comes out in this case, it's going to be the same thing. It's going to be about politically opportunistic, abusive, cynical people in power who are abusing the law to suppress legitimate dissent and suppress political organizing for their own manipulative political gain.
Larry, do you want to introduce?
Yes, I'd like to introduce Mordecai Spector, who will have a few words to say. Mordecai is the father of Max Spector, who's standing to his immediate left. Max is one of the defendants who is charged in this broad-ranging complaint. Mordecai has a very unique perspective. He's not only the father of one of the defendants, father of Max, but he's the editor and publisher of the American Jewish World. So given other circumstances and other times, he'd be standing on the other side of the table, getting information and asking questions. And indeed, he's been covering the Republican National Convention. So I'd like to hear the thoughts of Mordecai Spector.
I'm Max's dad. I'm here as a concerned parent. It's been a stressful week for my wife and I. Max was arrested Monday and held in solitary confinement in the Ramsey County Jail for 2 days. Finally was arraigned late yesterday afternoon. I arranged for a bail bond and got him out last night. As you heard from the lawyers, the criminal complaint here is far-fetched, overblown, outrageous. And I'm in the newspaper business, so I encourage all the journalists here to look into the specifics of this complaint, see where the truth really lies here. Max's house was raided, one of the three houses Saturday morning that was raided, and that seems to have set the tone, created more tension, which exploded on the streets of downtown St. Paul on Monday, with nearly 300 people being arrested. I'll just mention briefly that Max is from South Minneapolis. We live in South Minneapolis. Max has an older brother and a younger brother. He went to Seward Montessori School, South High School. He's in his third year at the University of Minnesota. As far as his Jewish education, he's a confirmand of the Temple of Aaron Synagogue Religious School and a graduate of the Talmud Torah of St. Paul Midrash Shah, the high school program there. So this is your domestic terrorist. Take a good look. I don't believe it at all. You know, give me a break.
Well, there you have this week's show. I've managed to pull some of the best indie media journalism segments for you here. Why indie media journalism? Well, like the police riots, Main Street Media, the six mega corporations that control 90% of all television, print, and radio media, did not bother to even tell you about this. Why? Because these are the same people who pay for the Democratic and Republican conventions. They have a vested interest in keeping the status quo. And believe me, Once they need us to be distracted enough, find a need to worry us, they might just bother enough to stumble upon these 9 or 8 domestic terrorists. More bread and games for this modern Roman Republic. I don't have the time or the energy to go into details of what I witnessed when I was arrested, held for 56 hours, and released without charges. And again, I wanted this show not to be about me. I wanted you all to hear what your government, or should I say, surrogate servants of the corporations are doing in your name with your tax dollars. I have a critique of what happened, and I'll go into more detail next week. I'd like to add, however, that if you're a poor person in this country, you are screwed in so many levels once you enter the police state system. There is no real due process anymore unless you have enough wealth to help you along the way. Kind of like if you don't have health insurance, I guess. But more on that next week. I hope you got something out of this week's Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show, bringing you a special report from the police riots in St. Paul, Minnesota during this year's RNC. And I hope you join me again next week. The Mike Cannon Show is produced for not-for-profit, community, and or micropower radio use worldwide at the Glee Glee Studios. I shall say goodbye for now, but remember, forever I am always yours in the struggle. Mike Cannon.
Justice, no peace.